Welcome to The More Perfect Union, a podcast about the joy we get from American politics, or as we like to call it, real debate without the hate. Hello, I'm Kevin Kelton. I'm a Democrat, and I live in Los Angeles, California.
Hi, I'm DJ McGuire from Suffolk, Virginia, and until the British actually go to the polls on the 8th of June, I'm calling myself a Tory.
Hello, I'm Molly Malloy Cooper. I'm a conservative capitalist enthusiast from Columbus, Ohio.
I'm Greg Matuszak. I'm a liberal Democrat from Cincinnati, Ohio.
I'm Cliff Dunn, and in light of the wonderful weather Virginia has been having this week, I am a party wet.
The More Perfect Union is one of the fastest growing political podcasts on iTunes. I promise you that. We can also be heard on YouTube, Facebook, and on our website, moreperfectunionpodcast.com, where you can also find host bios, and we occasionally will each write some kind of commentary that we post there. So please visit us there. Wow, another big week in the news. The President of the United States was on a whirlwind foreign tour this week. And my gosh, he hit a home run in every country he visited, or so he claims.
I was unaware he was playing baseball.
he was playing baseball, and the rest of the world was playing cricket. That was the problem.
But he did say that. He said, I hit a home run in every country.
I didn't see it as a success at all. I mean, starting from the goofy globe thing in Saudi Arabia and the sword dancing to NATO laughing at him and the pushing and shoving, everything about the trip seemed like a disaster.
You're making this sound like a Montana congressional race.
Yeah. When that's the best news that comes out of your foreign visit.
Well, what'd you guys think? Would you call this a success?
There were some successful elements, and I think the, you know, a little bit nitpicking. I mean, the globe thing and the I don't know, shoving the, you know, what is it, the representative from Montenegro? I mean, come on.
You're not a world power. You deserve to be shoved.
Well, I don't know about that, but I mean, yes, it could have been worse.
All right, well, let's start from the beginning.
Like, at least there was no reset button.
Well, there you go.
Well, here's the thing. I don't see how it could be a success when two of our biggest allies, Germany and Britain, both essentially washed their hands of us before the end of the visit.
Wash their hands is a bit much. The United Kingdom was very upset about our intelligence leaks into their investigation into Manchester, which we'll talk about a little later.
Well, that's what you Tories think.
Very funny. You know, as for Germany, yes, clearly continental Europe was not happy with Trump. They weren't happy with Trump when he landed. They weren't happy with Trump when he left. Germany in particular got a bit of a bad rap.
They weren't happy with Trump when he was elected.
No, they weren't happy at all. I would say in terms of the broader perspective of the trip, clearly the Saudis and the Sunni Gulf states are happier with Trump than they were with Obama. That's not necessarily a good thing, though, particularly given the disaster that is Yemen. I would have liked to have seen actually Trump make the Saudis a little more uncomfortable on human rights and civil rights in their own country. He chose not to do that. I would have liked Trump to have made them feel a little more uncomfortable about how they are really doing little, if anything, to help make things right in Syria. He didn't really do that. He didn't really focus on making the Saudis more uncomfortable about their Yemen campaign, which has been a complete disaster from a public relations perspective, from a military perspective in any way, shape, or form. He basically went over there, he signed an arms deal, and he made them feel good about themselves and about him. And that's nice, but I don't think that's what the Saudis needed. It's certainly not what we needed.
But let's be clear, though. Let's be clear. It was a huge arms deal. It wasn't just an arms deal. It was like one of the largest arms deal ever.
Well, and I'm personally hoping that he ends up charging them three times what the arms were worth and delivering them late, given how much I love the Saudis.
Now that would be worth it.
Well, given Trump's record, he probably will.
I don't know. It seems like he got them a good deal. And, you know, I don't like it on its face. I mean, honestly, though, somebody has to fight ISIS. And to the extent that we can outsource it to them, I guess that's good. But no, in general, I don't like, you know, I don't like I don't like the Saudis. I'll just say it.
Well, okay. I agree with you. So let me say this. I agree with you and Cliff and probably the rest of us on here. But forgetting Trump, forgetting Republican versus Democratic politics, when we make $100 billion arms deals to the Saudis, I know that there's jet fighters involved there. What are we giving them and what are we getting back for it? What are they doing with them?
We are giving them – I know that one of the big things was a THAAD. It's an air defense system. It's probably about to become the previous generation system. And we are getting back our oil money.
Okay, but what are we getting back in terms of their input into international peace? What are they doing with that military equipment?
Counterbalancing Iran.
Right. And that's what we're – you know, hopefully it's what they're doing is they're going against Iran. They're fighting ISIS. But, you know, I do. I have an uneasy feeling. You know, it just has kind of to me at least, a Afghanistan circa 1979, 1980 feel to it.
Right.
That I have some dis-ease with. But the alternative, you know, is – our boots on the ground, our blood and treasure. And so, yeah, I'm very conflicted.
Well, here's the thing. I agree with you about the alternative. Nobody wants to see our boots.
I'm one of those few. I want to see a military force liberating Syria, particularly Eastern Syria. And then we'll worry about the rest later. But go on.
Okay. Yeah, but let me just finish. This point is like, again, I just – the one thing none of us have ever heard is – oh, and the Saudi military lost another person today. I mean, what do? They don't fly missions. They don't fight. Can anyone point to one international crisis that they've played a part in resolving?
No. Making utterly worse? Look at Yemen. The military force will probably go into Yemen protecting their ally. Now, granted – the Iranian-backed Houthis in Yemen are bad. They're not good folks. A victory there would be a victory for Iran. But Saudi Arabia is doing everything possible to turn what might be a military victory into a political disaster. And if we're going to have – if we're going to be Saudi Arabia's ally, if we're going to have them be our ally, we really need to tell them that they've got to come up with a better way of defeating the enemy in Yemen, because what they've come up with so far has not worked.
So to use a horribly politically incorrect phrase, DJ, are you saying we need to have a come to Jesus talk with the Saudis?
Wow.
Yeah, I wouldn't exactly use that term. Wow.
Okay, and on that
note. Well, what about the rest of the trip though? I mean, let's take out the optics and I keep talking about the globe. The glowing globe, because if Obama had ever done anything about sticking his hand on a glowing globe, that would have been it for him. I mean, he couldn't have come back to America. Or if he would have done a sword dance. No!
Come on.
That was the weirdest thing in the world. That was so bizarre. Hey, everyone. Can everyone in this room, all the rich dudes, please?
So instead he just bowed to the king of Saudi Arabia. And there was a kerfluffle and life went on for another 7 years.
Right. Compare that to all the guys who are like leaders. Let's put our hands on this glowing globe, which everyone has to admit was weird. Let's move on past that for a second, which I'm going to keep talking about for the next 6 months.
I thought it was kind of cool. Weird, but cool.
Well, I know what I'm getting you for Christmas this year, Molly.
Oh!
No, but I actually think Greg has a point, because had Obama placed his hands on the orb, we would have all said, uh-oh, Sauron knows who he is, and he must go into the service of the Gondor steward for his own protection. You know, this is one that you're going to get partisan criticism.
Exactly.
But look, the Israel trip went very well. That doesn't really surprise any of us, because the Netanyahu and Trump get along very well, even though Trump basically admitted that, oh, yeah, it was Israeli intelligence that he gave to the Russians.
What about the Pope trip?
You know, he got out of there without, you know, doing anything so bad. I mean, you know, again, the Yeah, media wanted to focus on, you know, the veil of Melania, but
no, actually, you know, that's correct, though. That's exactly the same veil, pretty much the same veil that Michelle Obama, and that is pretty much, except for Gorbachev's wife wore a what was it, a really bright red jacket, and it caused quite a kerfluffle a couple years ago. Thank you. Yes, yes. I was saying the Italian word for it, though.
Yes.
But the veil is proper etiquette when dignitaries visit the Pope and have a papal audience. So that's pretty normal.
Yeah.
For lack of a better term, the real down part of the trip was the visit to Brussels. Our NATO allies in the continent are not comfortable with Trump. He is not comfortable with them. The European G7 nations are not very comfortable with Trump. He is not comfortable with them. Angela Merkel's in an election campaign, and she's treating Germany like it's all of Europe again. Never a good thing when a German head of government thinks they can speak for all of Europe. Just a warning here, but moving on. But in all seriousness, our NATO allies, with the possible exception of Great Britain, and there is feathers ruffled there, those relationships really are ruptured. I won't go so far as to say broken, but they are ruptured and damaged. And the question is, does Trump even care enough about those to try to repair them? If not, it's going to be a very rough 4 years across the Northern Atlantic.
Well, and I would say that I think there's a certain amount of, I'll just say, butthurt on Europe's part about Trump not wanting to go along with the Paris Climate Accord, too. And I think that is playing into this, aside from anything regarding NATO itself. Because remember, these are the countries that are pushing this.
And what I saw, of course, you see the news headline and the crawler about Angela Merkel saying, that we can't count on Trump. And I thought it was more of a general statement, but in context, it was specifically speaking about the Paris Accord. To some extent, I think it is kind of a gaffe that you go there and you haven't already, I'm going to let you know next week about whether or not I'm going to affirm this agreement, why that wasn't worked out ahead of time. Unless it's, brilliant strategy that we'll just punt and do it, later when we don't have the whole group together. But yeah.
Yeah. And the fact is, George W. Bush withdrew from Kyoto in 2001. It didn't really stop Europe from cooperating with him when the countries of Europe felt they needed to. If Donald Trump withdraws from the Paris Climate Agreement, which really just is, we agree to do something without ever saying what the heck it is. So it's just a piece of paper that says, yes, we're going to do something. There are no teeth to it. There's no specified plans listed out there. There's nothing like that. So I would say that if Merkel weren't running for re-election, this would not have nearly the punch that it does now. But because Merkel is running for re-election, it's more important to her that she looks like she's banging on against Trump for various things, and so that's what she's doing.
So speaking of horrible images, we talked a little bit about the veils, but what about the veiled budget that the Trump administration is trying to force down the throats of both Republicans and Democrats in the Congress? It's draconian. I mean, we could use a lot of adjectives. Does anybody think that this was anything but a first negotiating stance of, I know the car, lists for $45,000, but I offer $20,000. I mean, that's kind
every
of what
president
he did
does
here.
With the budget.
Oh, I mean, it's totally an opening salvo, but draconian, please, cuts in the rate of increases. It's no, I mean, this, what is it? Cruel. No, no.
Really? You don't think that it was drastic?
We went through this in 1995 when when the Republican Congress said, okay, instead of raising these things by 6%, we're going to raise them by only 3% a year. Everyone screamed, oh, those are horrible cuts. Bill Clinton ran against them and actually won re-election running against them because nobody noticed what was really going on. Look, this is a president's budget. President's budgets never get passed. They are an opening salvo. They're negotiating deal. I am actually concerned about the fact that the president chose to do nothing about reforming Social Security, about reforming Medicare. Medicare in particular is going to go way out of control on the spending side. He did a lot of discretionary budget cuts without really necessarily explaining them, which leads me to think they're more of a negotiating tactic. There are some very good things in here. I mean, the agricultural subsidies are getting whacked, and God knows we need to get rid of those as soon as humanly possible. There are a bunch of other things that, frankly, government should not be doing that it is doing anyway. But what Trump did was essentially he cut discretionary spending across the board rather than saying, I want to get rid of these things and keep those things over there. It's a standard mistake that Republican presidents do. They do across-the-board discretionary cuts because they want people to think that they're serious about reducing the size, scope, and cost of government. They're not. If you want to reduce the size, scope, and cost of government, you have government stop doing certain things. Trump didn't do that, so this is a negotiating ploy.
Good. If Rebecca was here, she also would say, this never gets through, just like you guys are saying. And it is a wish list, but the farm subsidies, there is no way a senator will not let those stay in place. And as much as we like to think that those should go away, those are not going away. And the worst part is these are Trump's base. Okay. The things that he does want to cut, which shocks me, which doesn't shock me, I shouldn't say that, is education. And he did, of course, when we can talk about Betsy DeVos and her lack of humanity. Yes, that's the word, humanity. She wants to cut education, public education funding by almost $10 billion. And yet charter schools, she wants to double the funding. I mean, that's criminal.
Because they actually teach kids, Greg. They actually teach kids and they have standards that they have to meet.
No!
Whereas public,
no!
Whereas, quote, institutional, unquote, public
no!
schools
charter
simply
school.
Rely like on the idiocy of the voters number. To re-elect school boards that do whatever the school system tells them to. I've crossed swords with school boards for decades, since I was six, since I was 16.
No, charter schools do not actually have to meet.
Most institutional public schools
do not actually have to meet the same standards.
Can we trick? Well, I've seen Virginia and I've seen New Jersey. And
no.
The standard is, can we trick the
electorate not in
into
Ohio.
Voting for the school board toadies that we want on the school board year after year after year after year after year? I've been crossing swords with school boards since I was 16 years old. I know what these people are like.
Right. Yeah, and I've been in the school district.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason the test in Virginia is the SOLs.
Well said.
Okay, and what about the CBO score of Trump Care? That came back this week. It was pretty much the same as the CBO score from the days when they couldn't pass it in the House. But the one that they passed is still going to knock 23 million people off of health care insurance coverage in the next 10 years.
Oh, stop talking about it like it's gospel. It's going to happen. CBO stands for constantly been off.
No, it stands for congressional budget off.
No, not in that one. They're talking about healthcare, not with given their record when trying to project.
I'll go ahead and say this. In the passenger rail advocacy world, there's a joke that the estimate will be whatever the estimate is, it will be off by 50%. Whether it will be 50% too high or 50% too low, God only knows, but it will be off by 50%.
So, Cliff, if we use that standard, then it could be 46 million. Oh, no, it could be 35 million.
Or it could be 12.
Or it could be 12. Okay, 12 so and if it's only 12
too.
Million, who cares, right? If only 12 million. No. Molly said if it's only 12 million, it's not that big a deal. 12 million fewer people with health insurance is no big deal. Right, Molly? Right, Molly?
It depends. I mean, they think at least 5 or 6 million are ones that have health care that they're paying for that they don't want to use. Some of them are on Medicaid that they're not going to bother to sign up for if they're not mandated to do so.
So you see no problem with this. You see no problem with this health care bill.
Oh, I see problems with this healthcare bill, but
what she said.
Well, what are the problems you see?
It's viability in the Senate.
No. That's politics. I want to know if any of the people who are on the right side of the ledger here see any serious faults with what was passed in the House.
I like the expansion of Medicaid, actually, and that is probably the biggest problem with, you know, taking that back. I don't like that. But this, you know, these waivers and letting them exempt out of requirements for these coverage things are absolutely necessary. This kind of, you know, half measure that we have, well, not a half measure, it's just, it's a completely you know, it's not insurance when you say there's like a very non-binding penalty for not carrying insurance, and yet we don't exclude pre-existing coverages, so you can get the insurance after you have the coverage, and that is why it's imploding and it has to be addressed. And
no, forget why Obamacare is imploding. Tell me why this is a good fix. Tell me why this is a good plan.
That is a different.
That's two different questions.
I don't understand how it's a different question.
I will tell you why it's a different question. It is a different question because you first asked what was wrong with the bill. She started going in chapter and verse. Then you start saying, "Well, no, I want to know why you think it's a good bill." She has never said it was a good bill. I don't know whether she thinks it's a good bill or not. I know it's a bad bill. I know there are plenty of reasons why it's a bad bill. You and I won't have the same reasons why it's a bad bill, but I know it's a bad bill. It's rinse and repeat. It's horrible. It saves at most $12 billion a year, which is a rounding error in the federal budget. It creates complete chaos in the health insurance realm, and it does nothing to actually address the healthcare shortage that we are dealing with because we're spending so much time ring around the Roseberry Bush on insurance access and spending no time about healthcare access and healthcare supply. This is, for the most part, a waste of time that is going to scare a bunch of people in the process and for no good reason. You want to fix healthcare, you get rid of Medicaid because it's just how we kill poor people in this country, and you shift the way the government does health insurance. If you're going to have the government in health insurance, make them the insurer of last resort, much like the National Flood Insurance Program, because no private insurer will do floods for property and casualty. Have the government insure the riskiest folks, period, and let everyone else who is healthy go through private insurance. That stabilizes the private insurance market, and it makes clear that the government is going to go, okay, we're going to cover the riskiest folks. It's going to be really expensive. Let's figure out how to get healthcare more innovative so that our costs can be reduced. Instead of having government as an insurer to healthy and poor people, then they act just like every other insurer, which is trying to maximize profits by minimizing costs. That is the problem with health insurance. That is the problem with healthcare. This bill doesn't fix either of them. Period.
Molly, that's the best answer you've ever given.
Her voice dropped an octave.
I do agree absolutely with the government having to be the insurer of last resort. And I do think that that probably is the case for pre-existing conditions as well as, well, no, but I do think we could voucher the poor that, you know, it does not have to be Medicaid in the way it is. And the elderly.
Age is a decent proxy for healthcare risk. Income is not a very good proxy for healthcare risk, and that's the problem. Yeah. There can be people. The problem with being poor is not that you can't get health insurance. The problem with being poor is that you're poor. You fix poverty with, say, a negative income tax. You don't fix it with Medicaid.
I'm agreeing with DJ.
Speaking of elections and international relations, we have to say that as bad as the U.S. intelligence leaks in Manchester of UK information might have been for international relations, nothing was quite as bad as the Republican congressman-elect from Montana taking a reporter from a British newspaper and body slamming him to the floor.
Well, it certainly gives a new meaning to punching the ballot.
It is interesting. Well, it puts paid to the – I mean, this – Congressman-elect Gianforte really did get into a fight with a guy who got with someone who gets inked by the barrel, and he still won, which you're not supposed to be able to do.
So here's where we get to have, you know, me agreeing with somebody I don't usually agree with is editorial in the New York Times about the downfalls of early voting. So, you know, and it is interesting that, you know, New York, and I'm not sure about Kevin, does California have early voting?
Yes.
Okay. So, but New York does not, you know, you vote on election day in New York. I mean, you know, they know who's going to win, so they don't have to have early voting, but, you know, in terms of, It's hard to, you know, figure out what happened there since 2/3 of the people voted beforehand. If we can get a hold of the data, I would love to hear if it's going to be, what was the margin, you know, of early voting versus day of voting.
Yeah, how he did on the actual voting day. Yeah,
because I heard it was like 70% voted early.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. But I have not been able to get a hold of disaggregated, if they even will disaggregate it, but I am fascinated by that.
Let's change the subject for a second and talk about the guy that we all love to love, Jared Kushner, everybody's favorite son-in-law, who now apparently is even a favorite of the FBI.
So every time when they start handing out impeachments, and they will, it will start with Trump and then Pence and then Ryan. And I can't wait till they start going to like Kushner, and I can't wait for them to impeach the son-in-law of the president at this point, because they're clearing house at this point. It's going to be awesome.
I don't think that's the actual process. I think what they do is they nullify the marriage to Ivanka. That's the actual legal process. What do they call in the Catholic Church? What is that called when they nullify?
Annulment.
Yes, they're going to annul their marriage. The Congress is going to annul their marriage.
I'll have to check what the Jewish equivalent of annulment is.
There's probably like 1,500 punchlines to that. does anybody believe that the FBI is not actively investigating this guy for potential criminal wrongdoing? You know, on the cable shows, they're selling this as, oh, he's just the subject or he's just a person of interest. It just means that he has information that the FBI wants. Does anybody really buy that?
No.
I mean, I think they're investigating him. Do I buy that they have anything? Not yet, no. But I do think they are investigating him, sure.
But investigating him for potential criminal misconduct, or investigating him like...
But he met with the Russians.
Right. So are they just investigating him like, he might have some interesting information that would help us understand Michael Flynn's situation better? Is that what you think is going on? Or do you think it's like, this guy might have actually been doing something with the Russians that is potentially illegal?
Like the back channel thing?
I think aside from the one or two undisclosed meetings, there might not be much more than smoke here. Yeah,
you think it's all smoke? You think it's all smoke?
Yeah, I like the back channel thing.
This is something else I wanted to kind of touch on this week. You know, I agree, when you coach it as, this was just a back channel approach to the Russians. And I've heard people say this on television too. They say, hey, you know, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Kennedy administration had a back channel to the Russians. So why shouldn't the Trump administration in waiting have a back channel? Well, first of all, the term back channel is a little bit loaded. It wasn't a back channel. It was a secret discussion with the Russians about things that they didn't want the public to know about, probably because it wasn't kosher. This wasn't just, oh, geez, we need a way to contact you people in case something comes up that doesn't go through, you know, the American media. This was a surreptitious attempt to hide from the FBI, the CIA, the NSA. He wanted to go into the Russian embassy and have communications from there with Russia. So the term back channel is actually not quite right.
First of all, given Manafort, given Carter Page and everything else, that the Trump administration does not have channels to the Russians. They have a whole freaking cable package. But the fact of the matter is, again, it's one of these things that I really worry about the opposition doing, is that we're spending all this time talking about legal this and legal that, and we are not spending the energy and time we should be spending on building the political case for why allying with Russia is a really, 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 really bad idea. We need to, because at some point, if they manage to get through all this stuff on technicalities, and it is certainly possible, Democrats need to be able to say, look, it doesn't really matter if they manage to skirt if they manage to break the spirit of the law while holding the letter of the law. The problem is closeness with Russia disturbs our allies, disturbs folks who are fighting for democracy around the world, and it sets back the cause of human rights. We need to be saying that over and over and over again, not just because, let's face it, we have all gone through things where right and legal are not necessarily the same thing, and wrong and illegal are not necessarily the same thing. We need the American people just to be able to say, you know, we don't know if Trump's ties with Russia were illegal or not, but they were wrong. They were wrong for America. We need to make sure that we're walking and chewing gum at the same time and making both cases. Don't just monopolize making the legal case, which may or may not be there. Talk also about the policy case, which is open and shut.
Well, it's not open and shut because if you're talking about democratic strategy, the original sin in needing to correspond with Russia goes back to Obama abdicating the responsibility in Syria and letting them take the lead on that.
And I don't dispute that. We'll need to walk away. Democrats will need to walk away from that, too.
So first of all, Kevin, thank you for you commenting that the Jewish son-in-law of the president was doing something that was not kosher. He must be reform. second of all, I think, you know, DJ is very much on to a point that I think the Democrats are in danger of committing a sin that they go out too aggressively on a legalistic impeachment charge and end up shooting themselves in the foot. And gee, where did we hear this story before? Oh, about 20 years ago.
20 years ago? Try 20 months ago.
No, he's referring to the Whitewater investigation, where the Clintons bled a savings and loan dry and got $50 million in taxpayer money to bail it out. And because Republicans focus so heavily on the legalistic aspects, voters didn't realize, oh, wait a minute, the Clintons just stole $15 million in taxpayer money to bail out their friend's SNL that they ruined. That message didn't cut through.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. But there, and, you know, I guess the opposite of that is that, you know, Hillary Clinton didn't do anything wrong with the server, but just because it wasn't illegal doesn't mean that it's something that the voters like.
That's right. True. That's absolutely true. And so what do you do when you're in that situation when you say whether it's Hillary Clinton who did something that we can all agree she shouldn't have done, or the Trump administration where you could say maybe they will never find the silver bullet or the smoking gun to prove criminality, but it was certainly a poor judgment in what they did. What do you do with that situation when you have an administration in power? We can't censure him. He's still going to be president for, you know, another 3.5 years. And it's not enough just to say, hey, let's all agree that it wasn't kosher to tie back into that. You know, that for me is a little too weak just to go, yeah, okay, the Trump people shouldn't have done that back in November and December. Slap on the wrist, public, you know, humiliation. But other than that, there's no consequence.
Oh, no, November, December. No, no, no. And that's where you are missing the forest for the trees, Kevin, because this isn't about what the Trump campaign may or may not have done in November of 2016 or before. It's about what the Trump administration is doing on policy right now. The very few good guys who are left in Syria are getting slaughtered and maimed because Donald Trump wants to let Russia wipe out whatever Russia considers a terrorist, which includes the few pro-democracy forces that are left. Donald Trump is being rolled by Vladimir Putin on matters around the world to our detriment. We should be talking about what President Trump is doing that is incorrect. We should be talking about it all of next year in the midterm elections. We should be talking about it throughout the 2020 campaign. It's not a matter of what Trump's aides may have done in terms of campaign laws or any of that sort of nonsense. It's about what Trump is doing on policy and why it is bad for the country. We need to talk about this over and over again, and we need to not stop talking about it until we put forth a Democratic nominee that says, no, I am not going to be rolled like Donald Trump was on Russia. I'm going to be clear-eyed on Vladimir Putin. I'm not going to make the mistakes of the last 4, 12, even 20 years regarding Moscow. I'm charting a different course. That's what Democrats need to do.
And with that, we thank everyone for listening. Please follow us on Twitter at MPU Podcast and on Facebook at facebook.com/MorePerfectUnionPodcast and share our link on your Facebook timeline so your friends can follow us too. And if you would like to join our political debate between shows, join us in our Facebook group, Open Fire Politics. Now, there's a couple of groups that are using that name now. So look for the original. Don't be fooled by fakes. It's Open Fire and then Politics in parentheses. We're all there. We'd love to see you there, too. Trademarked. And with that, everybody, final words, final thoughts?
I'm just amazed at how fast Cliff does math.
I think he has a calculator in his hand.
I'm not amazed at how fast Cliff does math anymore.